funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes a shooting star so unforgettable? While spotting a meteor's fiery fall toward Earth seems a rare and fortuitous pleasure, the truth is an estimated 8 meteorites land in every square mile of Earth every year. Still, recovering what remains following those glorious tumbles through space is no easy task, and doing so just once has been known to create instantly, hopelessly addicted amateur meteoriticists. Christopher Kokinos understands that both as a student of the science of meteors and as an experienced and successful meteorite hunter. For his day job, he is professor of English at Utah State University. His new book is called The Fallen Sky, An Intimate History of Shooting Stars. Chris, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you for having me, Chris. It's great to be here.
We should probably start with a little primer on some of the terms we'll be using here. Will you explain for us the difference between a meteoroid, a meteor, and a meteorite?
Yeah, I will, absolutely. A meteoroid is the thing out in outer space, like an asteroid, only smaller. And, you know, the size depends on who you're talking to, when it becomes a meteoroid versus when it's an asteroid. But it's a chunk of rock up there in outer space from the asteroid belt or from the surface of the moon or from the surface of Mars. And then when you see a shooting star, what we call a shooting star is a rock or even a piece of dust. The Perseids were firing off last week, the famous summer meteor shower. They never reach the surface of the Earth. So you see that shooting star go by, and it's just burning up. So that's the passing light of a grain of dust or something the size of, you know, gravel or a pea or whatever, or something much bigger. And it's burning up as it goes through the atmosphere. And if it survives to land on the planet, then we call it a meteorite.
And where do these things come from? You mentioned Mars and the moon. How do they get from where they started to the surface of the Earth if we actually find them as meteorites?
Well, they will definitely take the blue highways of the solar system. I mean, they have a pretty long route usually to get to Earth. The asteroid belt is between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, and it used to be thought that there was a huge planet that had been demolished, and that's why we had the asteroid belt. But it turns out nothing ever formed there, so it's kind of a ring of debris. And Jupiter will perturb the gravity of some of the orbits of some of those rocks in the asteroid belt and send them toward us. And the ones in their collisions up there. I mean, unlike the Hollywood movies where they're dodging rocks, you know, and flying through outer space, they're pretty well spaced apart, but they do hit each other. So those collisions will cause rocks to come toward us. And then the meteorites that come to us, a handful from the moon and a handful from Mars. I can't remember off the top of my head how many now we have in collections on this planet, but they get ejected off the surface of Mars or ejected off the surface of the moon by another impact. And so if it's powerful enough, it'll send that debris out, you know, from the moon and out from Mars. And if we're lucky, we'll find them here on planet Earth, which we have.
And that, of course, means that there might be chunks of planet Earth elsewhere.
Yes, indeed. That's absolutely the case. And one of the good arguments for sending more probes to the surface of the moon and more probes to Mars and even, you know, human space flight so we can find those things out. And, you know, there's an interesting debate about whether we're Martians or not, you know, and that's not going to be solved until we understand the mechanics, the mechanisms of material from one planet reaching another planet in greater detail.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute. I love thinking about this, the fact that we may very well have meteorites to thank for the fact that we and millions of other life forms on this planet are wandering around on the Earth today.
Yeah. Well, we do, and in two or three ways. You know, the meteorites get a lot of bad press. I mean, you know, we go down to the video store, get Deep Impact off of our Netflix queue, and they do represent a threat to civilization, and they have caused extinctions, and they do cause devastation, and they will again in the future. So we know about the bad press that these rocks get, but there's a side to them, and I didn't really know much about this until I started researching The Fallen Sky, is that meteorites, along with comets, which are in popular parlance, dirty snowballs, right? You know, chunks of ice and rock and gas and so forth. These things were hitting the primordial Earth about 4.6 billion years ago, delivering water, delivering carbon, delivering amino acids. So not life itself, but the building blocks of life arrived from outer space with these objects. And so we have, in a sense, a lot of thanks to give them for that. And then, as many people know, the dinosaur impact on the extinction event that happened about 65 million years ago, there were these small, rather insignificant critters running around the feet of the dinosaurs called mammals. And had the dinosaurs not been destroyed and cleared out in that extinction event, mammals would still be probably pretty small and insignificant. So we know that meteorites have had a positive impact, no pun intended, in terms of the evolution of life in that way. And then I also tell a story in the book about some somewhat controversial research about another impact that took place 500 million years ago, which may have also given rise to the first great diversification of life in the history of the planet, the so-called Cambrian explosion.
Let's talk for a minute about what makes meteorites so valuable to scientists. There are some that have entirely sort of melted and homogenized, and there are others that still contain original material from wherever it is they came from.
That's right. That's right. There are three basic categories of meteorites, stony meteorites, iron meteorites, and then, not surprisingly, stony iron meteorites. And if you can just briefly envision, you know, an asteroid or a globe in space, and the iron is the core of that globe, of that, you know, minor planet or asteroid, and it's molten, and then it hardens over time. Then you have the mixing zone between the crust, which is the crust would be the surface material mostly, at the top of the globe. That's the stony stuff. And then you have the stony iron in between. So that's kind of a quick view of what how these are constituted. And we have in these meteorites, as you said, the ones that have not been melted, that have not been thoroughly processed, original material not only from the formation of our solar system, but from other star systems, because our solar system was seeded with the gases and materials from supernova, from explosions in other star systems that have, you know, gathered together and were swirling together 4.6 billion years ago and created our solar system. So there's a really good reason why scientists say meteorites are the poor man's space probe. You know, we haven't mastered faster than light travel. We can't get on the Enterprise and go to, you know, the Romulan homeworld, but we can get samples from those stars because they're actually contained within the meteorites that land on planet Earth.
At what point, Chris, did humans first really understand that there were, in fact, rocks on the Earth that came from outer space?
Well, that's a really great question, because we tend to think of it, we're talking about it here today, as this purely scientific sort of question. But it turns out, and I was just thrilled to discover these things in writing The Fallen Sky, that indigenous cultures around the planet and across time have looked at shooting stars, for, you know, the lights passing through the atmosphere, and they've had different reactions to them. You know, we wish upon them in some instances. In other instances, they were you know, omens. They were meant to be avoided. You would avert your eyes. You didn't want to see them. And there was a connection drawn for a lot of cultures, Native American cultures. Some of them realized that these, you know, flashing lights and then these strange rocks that they found on the ground may be connected. And there, too, different cultures had different reactions. Some meteorites were worshipped and continue to be worshipped. Others were considered taboo. And so I go into some of the folklore and mythology of that in the book. And long about the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, with, you know, increased attention to the natural world, the Enlightenment has, you know, changed our way of looking at the universe, and natural historians are thinking seriously about how the universe works and looking at the world around them. One of the ironies is that they scoffed at the stories of folklore, the stories of mythology, the stories of peasants who were not to be trusted, people who said rocks fall from the sky. And a fortuitous set of meteorite falls in the late 18th century of stony meteorites of a particular kind. Fortunately for the chemists, they were all of a similar type. But they realized that, you know, there's stuff in here that doesn't occur on Earth. Nickel iron in particular, which is rare on Earth, is common in meteorites. So that happens. The chemists are looking at these things. And then there's a huge fall of meteorites. Thousands and thousands of meteorites fall on villages west of Paris, L'Aigle, in France in 1803. And at that point, it was sort of hard to ignore the fact that rocks fall from the sky.
Christopher Kokinos is my guest. His new book is called The Fallen Sky, An Intimate History of Shooting Stars. We should say that the book is also full of a lot of really interesting characters. One odd and highly driven man, and I hope I'll say his name right, Harvey Nieninger?
Yeah, that's right, Harvey Nieninger.
Mm-hmm. Had a huge impact on the interest that the scientific community had in what meteorites might actually teach us about the universe. Will you tell us a little bit about his career?
Oh, well, I'd love to. He's a great story, and not only a huge impact on science, but on the popular mind. I mean, he really popularized the fact that meteorites do fall from the sky. He's an interesting character because back in 1923, in the 1920s, he was teaching at a small school still operating today, wonderful college called McPherson College in South Central Kansas. He's walking back from a revival. It's a religious school, Church of the Brethren, and he's walking back from a revival on campus with his friend back home to his house, and it's a cold November night, and he sees a fireball. A huge, bright fireball, not your typical small, you know, shooting star. And his first reaction is to bend over the sidewalk and mark an X, because he knew if he could find where other people were standing, this is where he was, if he could find out from other people where they were standing, where they saw the meteor and so forth, he could correlate those reports and maybe actually find whether rocks fell from that meteor, and he could retrieve them. So he does search for it. He doesn't find any meteorites from that particular fireball, but he goes on to spend the rest of his life, and certainly at the beginning against prevailing scientific wisdom, people thinking he'll be lucky to find one meteorite in his life, and he finds hundreds. He amasses a collection of thousands. He quits his job during the Depression to hunt for meteorites. So he's an intriguing character and took some big risks, but and paid for that in some instances. But in the end, he succeeded.
And during this storied career, he also met up with a lot of other people who had a sort of similar passion, including many who recognized there must be something valuable about these things, but their families and friends said, "You are just insane. It's a pile of rocks."
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he interacts with another group of Kansans, a family named the Kimberleys, that in the 1880s, had homesteaded in Kansas, and they found a bunch of these big, old, heavy rocks. And the husband, Frank Kimberley, said, you know, they're just in the way of his plow. He was breaking up the sod. But his wife had recognized these as meteorites and eventually got scientists to come down to their farm in Kiowa County. And they were stony iron meteorites, which are very rare. I think they constitute about 1% of all meteorite falls. And she became the richest woman in the county virtually overnight. And Harvey Nieninger interacted with them late in their lives and went back to that area and worked that strewn field, as it's called, the area where the meteorites were found, found more of them, and they're meteorite hunters even today searching and finding those meteorites in central Kansas called the Brenham Palisades. So they're still there under the prairie soil.
And one of the reasons that they were found then is that it's a little bit easier to spot this odd rock if the land has already been somewhat cleared.
Yeah, that's right. And Kansas was a great place to hunt meteorites in the late part of the 19th century and into the 20th century because of that. Clearing the prairie, clearing the sod, you're going to find some rocks under there.
Christopher Kokinos is my guest. He's professor of English at Utah State University. His new book is called The Fallen Sky, An Intimate History of Shooting Stars. We'll go back to our conversation in a moment. You're welcome to join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Christopher Kokinos, whose new book is called The Fallen Sky, An Intimate History of Shooting Stars. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. And that's where we hear from Steve in Dallas. Hello, Steve.
Hi. I just wanted to get a comment on an experience I had. I've seen a few shooting stars in my life, but maybe 10 years ago I was in Japan and I saw one that was really bright and wide, you know. And at the end of the trail, it didn't just peter out, it seemed to actually explode, and I could actually hear, I think it was not very loud, but I could hear some kind of concussion or something like that.
Wow.
And there was a flash of light. And I just wanted to get your comment on that and try to explain why that could have happened. And I'll take your comments up here.
Thanks, Steve.
Great. Well, I'm envious. You saw both a fireball, which is what we call a really bright meteor, and a bolide, B-O-L-I-D-E, a bolide, which maybe sounds like a schoolyard insult, but it's actually a scientific term that means an explosion, you know, a fireball that explodes. So that, I mean, that's a pretty rare thing. So the concussion you heard was the object, the rock, blasting apart, and it may well have dropped meteorites. So that's a pretty cool thing to have seen. And he's off the air. I was just curious to find out where in Japan that was. But if you see something like that, you should report it to your local university or to, you know, if there's a natural history museum in the area, and let them know what you've seen. And again, be able to tell them where you were standing exactly and where you saw this thing start and where it ended. And if they can compile those reports, they can potentially recover meteorites from such an event.
When it comes to hunting for these things, there are two categories. There are falls, and that's when someone sees it fall and then goes and finds the object, and then there are finds, which might have been there for thousands of years.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about your first find?
My first find, yeah. My first find was in Antarctica. I have been working on the book for a while and knew early on, it took me 8 years to do the research and write the book, and I knew early on that two of the best places to go around the world to find meteorites. One was Antarctica. The other was North Africa, and there are a lot of meteorites coming out of North Africa that private collectors, private dealers are getting and putting on the market. And Antarctica is different in that it's also a desert, but it's much colder, obviously, and it's being hunted by scientists. Every year, Ralph Harvey, who's a planetary scientist at Case Western in Cleveland, leads an expedition that goes to Antarctica, funded by the National Science Foundation. And so I was privileged to have his blessing to join the expedition, and with some support from the National Science Foundation Visiting Artist Program, I went. And so I went there knowing that I would find meteorites, because they go to the places where those meteorites are surfacing on the ice. So in a sense, there was no drama, and I knew what that outcome would be, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got to our first field camp, and we're hammered by winds. We're having problems with the radio, and I get there with a couple of other folks, and they've already found meteorites. I mean, right after they landed the airplane, there were meteorites right near the camp, and I thought, that's impossible. There's no way. So I got to see one right away soon, but it wasn't until a few days into our being there that I was actually able to spot one myself from a snowmobile. And the only dark things in this area were meteorites or shadows. There were no other kinds of rocks. And I saw this thing, and it looked like a little squash. It was shaped like a little squash sitting there you know, on the ice with a little snow on it, and I was very excited.
It was incredibly difficult to work there in Antarctica, and we'll get into that more in a moment. But you also had an incident where you accidentally touched with your skin, rather than a gloved hand, one of these finds, and that is sort of a crisis for the scientists who are trying to recover these things.
Yeah, I'd say, well, it's a contamination event is what they call it, and it's not that
so clinical sounding.
People have done that. I of course felt pretty awful about it. It was the only time that I touched a meteorite in the wild, and I wish I could report some, you know, interesting radioactive experience or, you know, some sort of epiphany. But mostly, it was just feeling like, oh crap, I can't believe I did that. And other people have done that on those expeditions. But one of my favorite things that will happen on those expeditions is what they call roadkill, which is when somebody accidentally runs over a meteorite with their snowmobile. I didn't do that, fortunately.
What do scientists ideally want to do if they recover something in the wild and then they get it into a lab and they keep it pristine and uncontaminated? How do they go about studying it and slicing it up and figuring out what they can learn from it?
Well, that's you mentioned one of the first things they do. They take a thin section. They'll slice it up. And the meteorites from Antarctica, from the expedition, the Antarctic Search for Meteorites, or ANSMET, as it's called, those meteorites come to the Johnson Space Center, and a very cool lab. I had a great time visiting that laboratory, and they do initial classifications. We talked about those three broad categories of meteorites, stony meteorites, stony irons, and irons, and there are a multitude of really sometimes mind-numbing classifications within those categories, and it's up to the curatorial staff there at Johnson Space Center to make those initial calls. You know, this is a particular kind of iron, or this is a stony iron, or whatever. And they'll hold back the most interesting specimens, the really rare ones, and they'll send the others on to the Smithsonian. All of these are then made available to scientists around the world, and so they can look at these thin sections. They can see whether, you know, if it's a particular kind of chondrite or stony meteorite that has some unusual features. Maybe it's a carbonaceous chondrite, which is a rare form of meteorite that is, as its name implies, full of carbon. And those are those meteorites we were talking about earlier that help seed the planet with amino acids. So they'll look for some of these interesting anomalies, some of these rare specimens, and launch some very sophisticated and very detailed studies to determine, you know, the answers to a number of questions that scientists have about meteorites.
Christopher Kokinos is with us. His new book is called The Fallen Sky. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Next, we'll go to Ken in Plano. Hello, Ken.
Yes, hi. I'm curious to know what your thoughts are about the way science is packaged into sort of popular science, and we're talking about all these documentaries, the way they make their way onto the History Channel. Is this ever frustrating for you? You're an actual scientist looking into all this noise, and so for every nova, you have something like Monster Quest. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I agree. I wish I could say I am a scientist. I was an English major, so but I hang out with scientists. I get the good stuff. So I don't have to do the math. I can just get the interesting conversations. But I do agree that there is an unfortunate tendency in a lot of popular media, not just with films, but with some of the so-called documentaries you'll find on some of the cable channels, to really simplify questions, especially the impact question. I think for whatever reason, you know, we're really fascinated by the idea that something really big is going to smack us. You know, maybe that's a way of confronting our sense of mortality at an individual level, sort of transferring it to a cultural level. And I don't mean to discount that. It's important. We need to take these things seriously. We need to survey for asteroids that have our name on them, and we need to find ways to deflect them. But a lot of these documentaries are sort of pseudo-documentaries, and they don't particularly go into a lot of nuance. So I would refer people, like the caller, maybe frustrated a little bit with the lack of content in those shows, to, you know, to go buy some good science books.
How long did it take you, Chris, as a guy whose PhD is in English as opposed to in the physical sciences, to feel like you had the skills and the nomenclature to really have sort of higher-level discussions with people who did this for a living?
Well, that's a great question, because early on in writing this book, I was looking at some of these detailed studies and the classification schemes we were just discussing, and they're so complicated. They're so difficult to understand, I think, even for specialists sometimes. And I had a bit of a crisis. You know, it's like, I can't fully grasp this without a lot of help. And, you know, am I going to have to take some chemistry classes? Well, you know, what am I up to here? And at the same time, I was learning about the stories of people like Harvey Nininger, the Kansas meteorite hunter, or Daniel Berenger, the mining engineer who buys sight unseen Meteor Crater in Arizona and spends his years and fortune trying to find a meteorite under the soil that turns out had vanished. And he dies basically of a broken heart. And so I have this sort of bifurcated approach to the book. There's all this technical stuff, and there are these great human stories. And I realized that maybe part of the appeal would be I'm not a specialist, I'm not a scientist, and I will, with the reader, in a sense, learn at the same time. So it took me a few years before I felt like I had a basic grasp on the material that was enough that I could talk to scientists, I could talk to meteorite dealers, and I could ask them some informed questions. At the same time, you know, they would give me complicated, interesting scientific stories, and I would have to sort of relearn the material again.
I found your chapter on dealers really fascinating because, of course, they're in it for the money, but it's not uncommon for them to be so obsessed with collecting that they actually put out more money buying up these things than they ever take in.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And the science is really important to the collectors and the dealers. If listeners aren't familiar with this subculture, and I certainly wasn't when I started this book, it's a little bit like the fossil collecting subculture where you've got folks who are going out into the wild finding meteorites, bringing them back, and then selling them, but at the same time, with a real love of the science, and the scientific community has some pretty strict parameters that they will not study a meteorite unless it's been named. We know where it's fallen, and a dealer has to give a sample of that meteorite to the scientific community so that they have that sample, and then the dealer can go ahead and sell it on the market. I'm a birder. My first book was about extinct North American birds, and I thought the birding subculture was pretty obsessive, and they can't hold a candle to meteorite people. These folks are driven, they're obsessed, they're incredibly knowledgeable, they're very competitive, they're full of enthusiasm, and hanging out with them was a real delight and a little intimidating at first because of that enthusiasm and that expertise.
And in your experience, they're all pretty honest, or they tend to be pretty honest about giving that sample to the scientists?
Well, I think so. I do talk in that chapter about some of the tensions between the dealing, collecting community and the scientific community, and it really boils down to handing some of those samples over. Some of the meteorites, if someone finds a Martian meteorite, a meteorite from the surface of Mars, from the planet Mars, that's an incredibly valuable specimen. I saw for sale this was a few years ago, a store in New York City, a Martian meteorite the size of a pencil eraser that cost $3,500. So these are very valuable, and some collectors, or some dealers, I should say, are loath, you know, to give up any of that specimen to the scientific community. But the majority certainly are interested in that, and because the science is part of their passion, they want to know more about these things, just as the scientists do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Ron in Mineral Wells. Hey, Ron. Ron, hi. Are you with us? Okay, we don't have Ron. We will go next instead to Dawn in Dallas. Hello, Dawn.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
On July the 4th, I was driving from Dallas towards Fair Park where they have the fireworks, and I saw this big green firework, and then I saw a red thing, and I thought it would explode, but it never exploded. It just kept traveling east to west, and it went right over my head. And when it got over my head, it was like this huge fireball. And I stopped my car in the middle of the street so I could hear it or something, but I couldn't hear a sound. It was pretty high up, but it was going as slow as like when you're looking up in the air and you see a plane flying overhead. It looks like it's going very slow, but you know in your mind that it's going very fast.
Right.
And about so I got home, I tried to follow it, but of course I'm in my car and I couldn't follow it. And I got home and I emailed a couple friends, and 2 days later one of my friends sent me something in my email, and there had been a lot of people over Lake Arlington that saw the same thing when they were watching fireworks, which is about 45 minutes away from where I was, and it was about 45 minutes away from the time I saw it. So I don't know how fast that would have been traveling, but they saw a big, huge fireball, and it was traveling east to west. I would have thought a meteorite would have been pulled down by gravity and go at an angle or come straight down or something. I don't know what this was. I'm trying to figure it out.
Well, you probably did see a meteor, a fireball, as you said, and they come in at different angles. So sometimes they'll actually skip off the surface of the atmosphere. You'll see them pass through the upper reaches of the atmosphere, and they just keep going. They keep going back out into outer space. They can travel, they enter the atmosphere anywhere from about 7 miles per second to 44 miles per second. They start burning up at about 70 miles above the surface of the Earth, and we have to remember, too, and this was a mystery for a long time for scientists, once they figured out, yeah, these things are coming from beyond the atmosphere, the size of these fireballs seem, they're so huge, and they would ask, well, where are all the rocks if this thing is so big? Something the size of a raisin can produce a fireball, and a rock or object that is, about as wide as your leg is long can produce a fireball that's 200 times that size. So they'll often look so huge that you think, there's got to be a massive object in the middle of all that fire. And frequently, it's just not the case. But one of the things that you can do is, talk to some folks at local universities. I believe it's, drawing a blank, the Oscar Monig meteorite collection, I think, is at TCU. So there are experts out there who probably have gotten some of these reports and find out if folks are hunting for meteorites there.
Christopher Kokinos is with us. He's professor of English at Utah State University. We're talking about his new book, The Fallen Sky, An Intimate History of Shooting Stars. We'll be back in just a moment to our conversation. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Christopher Kokinos. His new book is called The Fallen Sky, An Intimate History of Shooting Stars. You can join us via email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Steve in Dallas, who asks, can meteorites bring dangerous biological matter within our atmosphere?
Well, conceivably they could, but there's certainly no instance of that. So there's no, there's certainly any... I wouldn't be worried about that. But back in the Apollo days, there was concern about contamination and some of the meteorites that they were looking at the time seemed to suggest that there were microfossils and so forth. And that's one of the reasons why the Apollo astronauts were quarantined after their flights. But that there really is no reason to worry about biological contaminants coming into the atmosphere from meteorites. The bigger worry would be the potential for impact, and scientists are surveying the sky for asteroids that cross our orbit, and there are serious and interesting ideas out there for how to deflect a potential incoming asteroid if we have enough warning.
Yeah, the movies, do they get it right there in terms of setting off?
Don't. Surprisingly so. I can't remember which one. I can't remember if it's Armageddon or Deep Impact now. I've seen them both several times. They're great eye candy. I would sit and watch them and call it research, when I was just basically wanting to zoom out. One of them, they blow up the object, and instead of one big meteorite coming in, you've got thousands. This is not really a good idea. There's a group called the B612 Foundation, which is headed by former Apollo astronaut Rusty Schweikert, and they're interested in a controlled deflection of an asteroid sometime in the next few years. Different, I explore some of this in the book. There are different ideas. I think one of the least dramatic but most, I think, reasonable ideas is you simply send a probe up to an object in space and you park it over that asteroid or that meteoroid, and the mass of that probe will be enough to deflect it off its orbit over time. So there are ways absolutely to deal with this, and I think the scientific community understands that. I'm not sure that folks beyond NASA are taking this as seriously as they could.
Yeah, we've had Rusty Schweikert on the show, and he's a fascinating guy. And it's funny that a lot of people think he's crazy, and it does seem that at some point we might consider that work very important.
Oh, it's absolutely crucial. Things hit us. You know, we have had impacts hit us in the recent past. Just over a century ago, the Siberian forest of Tunguska was destroyed. 2,000 square kilometers of forest were devastated by a comet, it appears, that had the force of a 15-megaton explosion. That was just a century ago. Every 500 years, we can expect an event like that. Every 200 years, we can expect an event of the size that formed Meteor Crater in Arizona, which was an object that was just 150 feet wide, but it was made of iron, and the air did not slow it down, and it blew out an area, destroyed an area of about 100 miles, square miles around what is now Meteor Crater, Arizona. Imagine that happening today to a city, and Hollywood's good at imagining those things. But now we have to think of this as not science fiction, but an actual threat to human civilization. And so it absolutely should be taken seriously.
Let's go next to Phil in Dallas. Hey, Phil.
Hello. My boys and I were dove hunting in the Stephenville area several years ago, and we stumbled on an area that was scattered with what looked to be rock debris, but when we started looking at them, they were irregular in shape. Some of them were smooth. They were not rocks, and there didn't seem to be any kind of impact area, and they were very, very heavy.
Did you take any home, Phil?
I'm sorry?
Excuse me. Did you take anything home?
We did. We picked up three or four and took them home, and we've got, they're still around the house somewhere. And what really triggered my call was your guest saying that when you find something like that, you need to call the museum or a university or whatever.
Right.
And that was, my boys were like 12, 14 years old, and now they're 25 and 30. Could that have been an impact zone?
Well, it could have been, and I think it's never too late to take a sample into a lab. So I would again, I'll put a plug in again for the folks at TCU at the Oscar Monig Meteorite Museum there. Definitely would get in touch with them, take a sample to them, take a map, show them where you were, and they can certainly help. Something to note about meteorites, they're often, well, the meteorites that you mentioned, Chris, at the beginning of the show, that we get 8 new meteorites per square mile every year on the planet. Most of those are very small, but some of them aren't. But they probably aren't big enough typically to form a big crater. They get slowed down by the air, and they just land at sort of normal velocity. So you may not find a giant hole in the ground when you come across a meteorite. And then you need to look for things like, is this different from the rock around the area in general? Does it seem heavier than a typical rock of a terrestrial rock of about the same size? If it has holes in it, little vesicles, as they call them, like blowholes, gas holes that you'd see in volcanic rock, then it's not a meteorite. Does it have any magnetism at all? Is it brownish? Is it blackish? Does it look like it has a crust of, sort of sheen, a black sheen on it? That's called a fusion crust, where it was melting as it came through the atmosphere. Is the interior light or silvery? Those are all questions to ask, and if you get some positive answers to some of those questions, then you may have a meteorite on your hands.
And contrary to what we might imagine, they are typically not sort of stunningly beautiful objects.
No, they're not. They're really kind of ugly. I mean, I have a handful of meteorites, and I have my favorite, which is one of a chondrite, one of those stony meteorites. Came from North Africa, and it's about the size of an apple, and it's just this brown rock, you know. And if you didn't know what you were looking at, you probably would have just left it in the field, you know. But here is this thing that's 4.6 billion years old. It's seething with information. If you hold a meteorite like this, an ordinary chondrite, in your hands, you're holding something in your hands that is a chemical match to the sun, minus hydrogen and helium. The rest of its constituent components there are an exact match to the chemistry of the sun. So you're holding a piece of the sky in your hands. So meteorites they're just rocks. I mean, and I think for most of us, you know, rocks are something that chips our windshields right on the highway, or we get them in our shoes. But these are rocks that are kind of the alpha and omega of geology.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Edward in McKinney. Hey, Edward.
Hi. How are you folks doing today?
Great. Good. Thanks.
Well, I was listening to your talking about Winslow Crater, and I do recommend everybody go out there. It is beautiful enough. That whole area is just beautiful enough to make you kind of question the divine, really. But that's not really my question. I called in. I've seen several fireballs in my day, and some of them have different colors to them. They have like a green sheen, a red sheen. I've even seen kind of a bluish tinge. I was wondering if you could kind of explain why that is.
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and I'm good for you for being outside enough to see these things. The colors are really an indication of what's burning up, and the color is a kind of display of chemistry up there in the sky. If it's a red trail or red fireball, you see the color of the tail, I should say. If it's red, it's primarily silicon. If it's yellow, it's primarily iron. If it's orange-yellow, it's primarily sodium. My favorite color is the sort of ethereal bluish green of some meteors, and that's the color of magnesium. And calcium colors the meteorite tail violet. So as you watch these things, you're not only able to witness this beautiful, aesthetically pleasing event, but you're also able to sort of do this science lab test just with your eyes.
We should point out the common misconception would be that these things only happen at night, but in fact it's 24 hours a day.
24 hours a day, absolutely. I mean, the sun washes the sky with its light, and if we could somehow arrange to see through that, you would see millions of meteors firing across the sky during the day. I mean, it's our sky is trellised with these things, and they're happening all the time.
Let's go next to John in Denton. Hello, John.
Hello. My question has to do with you've talked about the number of these things coming down, and it's a lot more than people would imagine.
Right.
And so you would think that there would be more encounters in terms of kind of violent encounters, even if they're small, you know, hitting cars and buildings and
right.
whatnot like that. Can you just comment on that? You did kind of answer something a little while ago. You said that by the time they get low enough, they're actually going slower than I might
right.
have thought.
Well, that's true. And you know, in the list of things that we should worry about, I wouldn't put a personal impact high on the list. The odds are trillions to one, and I think the latest statistic I saw about getting hit by a car is like 1 in 47,000. So we're pretty safe. We don't have to wear hard hats, I think. But they are falling all the time. But the planet's big, and most of it's ocean, and a lot of these things are falling in. If they do reach the surface of the planet, they're landing in water. They're landing in remote places. About five times a day, a meteorite of about 13 pounds will hit the surface of the Earth. But, you know, think about how large the planet is. With, five of those a day, it's really not that much. In Arizona, David Kring, who's a scientist there, has estimated that about 800 meteorites have fallen in Arizona, what is now Arizona, since the 17th century. Meteorites of about 2 pounds or more. So, that would be the size of that you could find pretty easily. But only 31 out of those estimated 800 2 pounds or more meteorites have ever been found. So they are falling, but they all, you know, they're falling all over in remote places and in the water. There's only one documented, real well-documented case of a person being injured by a meteorite, and I tell that story in the book. So that's one out of how many meteorite falls.
So one less thing to worry about.
One less thing to worry about, yeah.
Let's go next to San Antonio, where we'll speak with Hannah. Hello, Hannah.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A friend of mine was able to locate I don't know if it was a meteorite or a volcanic rock, actually, now that I've heard the difference.
Uh-huh.
But it had a very unique smell to it. You know, it was almost organic and different than anything else I'd ever experienced. And from what you say, I realize that would be a contamination event. But I'm wondering if you were able to notice the same thing while you were out in the field, or if you just weren't able to touch them and, you know, have physical contact with
right.
them.
Right. Well, we weren't supposed to touch them, so we didn't. But we could get close to them. We would scoot up one of the field camps I was at. We were looking for meteorites among other types of rocks, and we would get off our snowmobiles, and we'd be on all fours or on our bellies, like eyeball to eyeball with this rock, trying to figure out what it was. So if they had a smell, we would have been able to smell them. And some of them do have smells, but typically they've been out in the field so long that that's not going to be the case. But there are reports of a sulfurous smell with some meteorite falls, but they'd have to be really fresh. So I'm not sure what you know the circumstances were of your friend finding that, but chances are that probably wasn't a meteorite. But there too, why sit on it? I'd take it in and show an expert.
So the next big meteor shower is the Draconid in October?
Yes, but I think the one I always talk up is the Leonids in November, mm-hmm. And because they're slow and big. And I don't have in front of me when those peak. It's typically mid-November. You can get on the web.
17th and 18th, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you can find that out relatively easily. And there are meteor showers throughout the year, and you can find the dates and peaks of those really easily. And I would get out and take a look at them. Chris, very quickly, I wanted to just note how interesting it is to hear people calling in and telling these stories, right, of seeing these things or finding these unusual objects. And for whatever reason, they still have this power over us. And even having the scientific understanding we have of meteors and meteorites, we still look at them. We still find them. We still want to tell stories about them because they're so strange and wondrous, even though we may know more about them than, say, you know, folks 500 years ago.
Yeah, they're sort of mystical in that way.
They speak to the wonder of the universe.
Christopher Kokinos is professor of English at Utah State University. His book is called The Fallen Sky, An Intimate History of Shooting Stars. Chris, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. It's been great.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.